You know, when I realized that February 20th, 1972, meant that it's been 10 years, a whole decade, since America's first manned orbital flight, and suddenly I remembered way back 10 years ago when John Glenn went into orbit around the Earth and we all sat breathlessly wondering if man could survive the weightlessness of space for this long a period of time. And since then, so much has happened. We've covered so many manned space flights, it's almost hard to believe that we had these questions 10 years ago. And I'm very happy that John is with us today to reminisce about this decade past, and particularly about all of the things that were so unusual back when he first went into space on February 20th, 1962. Time's passed awfully fast, hasn't it, John?
Well, it certainly has, and I think memories of the flight, though, and that time period and what we were about at that time or what the answers we were trying to get, I think they've remained fairly fresh in our minds. So the 10 years has gone very fast, and it's hard to believe we've accomplished so much and are on to such a much bigger purpose and so much broader objectives now than we were that time 10 years ago.
What's happened in your life in this 10 years?
Oh, many things. After my flight in 62, Bob Gilruth, who ran the manned spacecraft center up until just all during the formative years and up until just a few days ago, of course, Bob talked to me about what my role in the program should be beyond that time period, and he felt that since I was the oldest of the first group of astronauts, that probably my looking forward to continuing on active training, looking forward to an early lunar landing or Apollo mission that we thought at that time would occur maybe in the 1970 to 1972 time period, would probably be wishful thinking. I was going to be at or beyond 50 years of age by that time. And he was suggesting then that I go into an area of training or management, and I felt at that time that perhaps there were many people could do that, and that if I was to be no longer on the active list, that I would rather do some other things. So,
how does a pilot not fly as a pilot anymore? He gets into something else, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's right. And so there were many opportunities in business and so on that I elected not to take at that time. Many of them quite lucrative, I might add. So we passed those up, and I was going to run for the Senate at that time, and I had just declared my candidacy, but then I fell in an accident, hit my head, and had a little fracture down through the labyrinth area in the left ear that really knocked me out of everything for almost a year. And so I was out of everything, was flat on my back during a good part of that year, but fortunately got full recovery and then did get involved in the business world to some extent after that with Royal Crown and was president of their international organization for a while. And then elected to run for the Senate again, and was defeated in the primary year before last. And so we're involved now with efforts in some of the construction of some of the new Holiday Inns. I'm a part franchise holder in four of those efforts. Mm-hmm. And we're looking forward to getting them open and being a little more active. And I don't know what the future holds yet as whether politically we come back for another try one of these days or not. I certainly don't rule it out, let's put it that way. But I can't say for sure what will happen, because the next Senate seat in Ohio will be up for election in 1974, so that's a little ahead of us yet, so we'll see what happens.
As they say, usually once that thing called politics grabs you, you don't ever let it loose. So.
Well, I've been interested in the problems we're facing for a long time, and I think if I could apply whatever intelligence and expertise I have in these areas, I can't think of any greater challenge or better use I could put my life to than helping work on some of those problems. I think also perhaps there is a great lack in our Congress and in our Senate of experience with a background in science and technology, and this affects everything we do these days. And this is not to say that if I was ever successful in getting into one of those spots, that I would be a rubber stamp for anything that's done in the way of science or technology. Quite the opposite. I think with some of my background and training that I could perhaps better evaluate some of the technical advances that are considered in the Congress, and also in the space program, of course, and militarily in some of the projects that are called for from time to time. I think my background might be a good one to have in that area.
Let's steer this towards science and technology, and particularly go back 10 years ago and discuss what you were trying to accomplish, what you were trying to determine then as to whether man could even survive in space or not, and what we've learned in this decade.
Well, when you look back on that period of time and try and define what our objectives were, it seems almost laughable now that at that time our biggest problem was trying to determine what man's own physical limits were in space. We were trying to answer such questions as, in an extended period of weightlessness of several hours, does man's eyeball change shape once it no longer has to be supported with the muscle structure under the eye? What happens to the inner ear? Does the fluid floating around in the inner ear cause such disorientation that there's complete disorientation and you're not capable of any coherent or constructive work?
Can you move your arms, your muscles?
Right. Or when you we even had a one of the things to be determined was, if you reach for a switch in a weightless condition, do you automatically reach above the switch? Because you life's training on Earth is to reach, taking into account the effect of gravity, the weight of your arm. Do you reach above all the time? And we wanted to determine all these things so that we could better know what man might accomplish scientifically, not just whether he could stay alive in space, but what would be his ability to run projects in space, to use space as a new laboratory. Could he orient his thinking? Could he do things on the lunar surface and get new information that would benefit us in the future? Could he come back in Earth orbiting vehicles around the Earth and run projects oriented towards, say, pollution analysis and control here on Earth, weather control, new energy sources? In other words, can we get new energy sources? All of these things, of course, are using man's particular capabilities in space to run projects that are worthwhile, just as though space is a laboratory.
You proved within minutes after going into space that man could function, didn't you?
Well, I think by the end of the flight, at least, we had a pretty good answer on it, because a lot of the dire predictions that some of our physiologists and doctors had predicted did not come true. And I think, although we looked upon it as a an unplanned for thing at the time, one of the things that happened on the flight was very fortuitous. Well, as it turned out, at the end of the first orbit, the automatic system that was controlling the spacecraft had a malfunction, and I was forced to take over and control the thing manually at the end of the first orbit. So we answered some of those questions rather rapidly and of necessity. Mm-hmm. And so it worked out very well. And I think by the end of the flight, at the end of the nearly 5 hours, we had pretty good answers on what man's limitations were and what his visual acuity was, what he was capable of doing, and could then go on and further define this on later flights, but more importantly, could go ahead right from that time on and plan for man to be part of the working system in the spacecraft and could design scientific projects for him to do while he is on board that hopefully would be of benefit then to everyone here on Earth.
Thanks very much for being with us today, John Glenn, and reminiscing about that first flight, that first orbital flight 10 years ago. This is Rhett Turner. John, when you performed your very first United States manned orbital flight, the public reaction was so immense, both in the United States and around the world, that I think every human being in the world had empathy and a feeling of kinship with you, and this was reflected in the great number of letters you received. And you put together a book about it. I wonder if you'd just chat with us just a bit about some of the impressions that you got from letters from people all over the world.
Well, you know, the first 6 months after the flight, there was such an outpouring of people that were outpouring of mail from people who had been interested or had watched or had some feeling they wished to express. And as I recall, I think we received somewhere between 350 and 500,000 letters in the first 6 months. Steve Grillo, who was the administrative assistant or administrative affairs officer at NASA headquarters at that time, actually had to set up a special mail room just to handle the mail addressed to me from all over the world. And we saw that everyone got an answer, of course, and so I couldn't obviously answer every letter personally, but we saw that someone answered every letter at least. Later on in 1964, then, when I was hurt and was out of everything for about a year, we decided so many of these letters had been of interest that we culled through some of the boxes of mail that were left over and picked out some of the ones we thought would be of interest and from people all over the world, and we put them together in a book. And it was of interest because there were many who had expressed had responded to some of my statements on religious feelings, or told me where they were and what they had been doing when I was in flight, or many children wrote they were particularly interested. We called the book P.S. I Listen to Your Heartbeat. And the idea behind that title of letters to me was from a little girl who had written to me about how what she had thought about the flight, signed her name to the bottom of the letter, and then said, P.S., added a postscript, P.S., I listened to your heartbeat, which, of course, referred to the fact that my actual heartbeat had been carried on telemetry, which was sent by radio signal to ground and was put out over the radio and television around the world. And so people had literally listened to the thump, thump, thump of my heart when this was put out over the radio and had listened to my heartbeat in orbit. Well, while that was indicative of the flow of information to people around the world, I also felt that through this massive outpouring of letters, in a way, I too had listened to the heartbeat of many, many people around the world and what they thought and felt, and their hopes and fears and their wants and their problems with their children they expressed, and what they hoped for their children in the future. And it was really, I listened to the heartbeat and the hopes and the fears of many people around the world in return, and tried to answer many of these questions they posed to me or thoughts they expressed, and I just appreciated the mail very much.
You even got a feeling of the whole world being with you during the flight, too, as I recall. I'm thinking specifically of Perth, Australia.
Yes, right. Yeah, we sure did. There was so much attention on the flight at that time, of course, and you mentioned the Perth, Australia. I still am looking forward to visiting Perth one of these days. I was in Australia about a year ago, but I was in the Melbourne area and didn't have a chance to get to Perth. But the people of Perth, knowing that at the time of my flight, that they would be on the dark side of the earth during that period, they all got together and lit up every light in town and had all of their means of illumination on at that time. And the orbital track that I was following went right over Perth on the first orbit. And so there I was in the middle of my first night on the dark side of the earth, less than an hour after launch, and could look down and could see the lights of Perth very clearly down below. And so I thanked them very much for it, and this received quite a lot of attention, of course, in Australia and some other parts of the world, too. The man that was the Lord Mayor of Perth then came through and was with us in New York during the celebration after the flight when we had the ticker tape parade. And we had a good time with him there and thanked him very much for making sure that all the people had turned the lights on for us.
Well, John, I don't think that any manned flight before or since has really created this immense human warmth that your first Earth orbital flight did 10 years ago.
Well, I think some of these first events, such as the first suborbital flight, my first orbital flight, the first flight around the moon, the first lunar landing, I think any of these things that are so new automatically capture the attention of people all over the world. I'm sure you'd agree with me that our biggest, fondest hope in the space program has been that this type feeling, this interest in each one of us as persons and as fellow human beings and as searchers for new information, this interest in us is shared in reverse also in our interest in people in other areas. And our biggest hope is that somehow maybe this one area, space, where man has never yet started to fight, that we can always keep it clear of any unhappiness like that, and that this information we get back from space can just be used for the benefit of all people all over the earth. I just hope we can always keep it that way.
Thanks very much, John Glenn, for looking back with us 10 years ago to that first Earth-orbiting flight of Friendship 7. This is Rhett Turner.